From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Islamic militants have increased their suicide attacks within Pakistan since the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. In the past 2 weeks, three of Pakistan's major cities have been hit, including Lahore. On today's Fresh Air, we speak again with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He lives in Lahore. We'll talk about what these attacks mean for Pakistan and for the U.S. Pakistan is on the front line in the fight against terrorism. Rashid knew Benazir Bhutto and spent time with her family after the assassination. We'll talk about the aftermath of the assassination and why her 19-year-old son is now the head of her party. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Sue Miller's new novel, The Senator's Wife. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pakistan is on the front line in the fight against terrorism, which is why we often check in with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of the books Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. His forthcoming book will be about nation building in Pakistan and Afghanistan and U.S. policy after 9/11. Since the assassination of Benazir Bhutto in December, Islamic militants have escalated their attempts to destabilize the Pakistani government and have increased the frequency of suicide attacks within the country. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is considering expanding CIA and military activities in Pakistan. The parliamentary election, in which Benazir Bhutto hoped to emerge as prime minister, has been rescheduled for February 18th. But there are doubts about whether the election will be fair, and even doubts about whether President Musharraf will allow it to proceed. Musharraf has embarked on a European speaking tour that will take him to Davos, Switzerland tomorrow, where the World Economic Forum is underway. Ahmed Rashid is attending the forum. This morning, he went to his studio there. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. The suicide attacks in Pakistan have increased since the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Can you describe the scope of the attacks?
Well, they've become much worse and much more varied. For example, we had the first major suicide attack in my hometown of Lahore, where 22 policemen were killed on the main road outside the High Court. And a suicide bomber got off a motorbike and just waded in to these policemen who were waiting for a lawyer's demonstration. And he killed 22 policemen. It's been absolutely devastating. And as a result of that, you know, Lahore is the center of political activity. It's the center for the elections that are forthcoming. And literally, the politicians, people have just gone kind of underground. And there have been other suicide attacks, of course, in the northern areas, in the frontier regions with Afghanistan, where the extremists have targeted, again, the army, paramilitary forces. And they've gained quite a lot of ground up there also. We've had major attacks on army forts in the tribal areas, very close to the border with Afghanistan. One fort was attacked by 600 militants, and it was being guarded by some 50 soldiers, and about half the soldiers were killed, and the rest were either captured or fled, and the fort fell to the militants. And the militants, you know, looted it for a bit, and then they abandoned it. And they've attacked two or three other forts in a similar way. Now, it's been quite extraordinary, because, I mean, to gather 400 to 600 men in one location, even in very obscure mountains, means that obviously there's a huge organizational capability that these people now have.
Who's behind the attacks and what are their goals?
Well, you know, the overall leader of the militants is a man called Baitullah Masood, who's a Pashtun tribesman from the Masood tribal area. He was a former fighter for the Taliban. He helped Al-Qaeda in 2001 escape from Afghanistan. And he's only 34. He's very, very young. He's built himself up, as it were. And he's now been acknowledged by all the various militias. It's not a unified command. I mean, every tribe has got its own militia. And even within these militias, there are several factions. But he has been acknowledged as the overall commander of what has now been called the Movement of the Pakistani Taliban, which is a group of militias who acknowledge him as the leader. And clearly, the fact that he's managed to get all these tribesmen together to take on these major military targets means that he has clout and authority. Now, he is the same person who has been accused by the government of killing Benazir Bhutto, which he has denied, of course. But it seems very, very likely now that either directly or indirectly, because he also has links in the urban areas, he's got terrorist groups who owe him allegiance in major cities, either him, you know, his own group directly or other groups that are linked to him probably did try and assassinate Bhutto.
What does he want? What's his goal?
Well, again, I mean, it's very, very difficult to say. He says he wants to topple President Musharraf. He wants Sharia, that is Islamic law. It's not quite clear if he wants it just in the northern part of Pakistan where the Pashtun tribes live, or whether he wants it for the whole of Pakistan. So it's not a clear-cut agenda, but it's an agenda basically to destabilize the government as much as possible, to target the security forces, to make the public lose faith in the security forces, and make the public lose faith in the government.
So, is the Pakistani Taliban that he is a leader of connected to the Afghanistan Taliban and to Al-Qaeda?
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, these Pakistani Taliban have grown up, if you like, since 9/11 under the shadow of Al-Qaeda. They've been ideologized, they've been funded, they've been armed, they've had Arab trainers coming across from Iraq and from the Middle East to train them. So there's a very, very close linkage with what we would call now the Arab Al-Qaeda, if you like. That is Osama bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who are both hiding out in this tribal area. And secondly, of course, there's a very close connection to the Afghan Taliban, because it was these Pakistani Pashtun tribesmen who in 2002 gave refuge to those Afghan Taliban who escaped from Afghanistan and then came across the border into Pakistan and took refuge. And for 2 or 3 years they were not touched by the army. They were free to live in the tribal areas. They were free to socialize, to train, to meet, etc. And it wasn't until 2004, 2005 that the army actually went into these areas.
The New York Times recently ran a story based on anonymous sources within the Pakistani intelligence services. And this is a very secretive intelligence service. And what the Times reported was that the Pakistani intelligence service had lost control of some of the networks of Pakistani militants that it had nurtured since the 1980s and was now suffering blowback of that policy. And the militants had turned against the intelligence services. Could you explain what's going on there?
Well, the Pakistani intelligence services, that is the inter-services intelligence, the ISI, which is a branch of the army, trained tens of thousands of Pakistanis and Afghans since the 1980s, along with the CIA, of course, to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And once the Soviets left, and the Americans left also, the ISI continued training young Pakistanis to fight with the Taliban, because, of course, Pakistan was one of the very few countries in the world that supported the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Now, parallel to that, the ISI was also involved in training tens of thousands of Pakistanis to fight in Kashmir. In the 90s, there was this very bloody insurgency in Indian Kashmir, and Pakistani and Kashmiris were being infiltrated from the Pakistan side of the border into Indian Kashmir, where they were carrying out guerrilla attacks and then coming back. So there was this kind of tit-for-tat proxy war going on between India and Pakistan. Now, I think, I mean, what has been happening for not just now, but for the last 2 or 3 years is the blowback to that, in the sense that Musharraf has improved relations with India. We don't really need now this proxy extremist force of militants to fight the Indian army in Kashmir. But these young kids haven't been properly disbanded. They haven't been re-educated. They haven't been given any jobs. So what do? They go and they join up with Al-Qaeda, or they join up with the Taliban. Some of them may go home and do nothing, but there too they become fed up, and then their comrades recruit them again. So you've got this huge kind of lumpen elements of unemployed, very poorly educated, thousands of young men whose only training has been military training. That's all they're fit for. And the temptation now, of course, with the kind of clarion calls for arms by Al-Qaeda, by the Taliban, by Pakistani extremist leaders, many of these young guys have joined up with these groups. So, I mean, that's what the real threat is. And of course, the ISI really lost control of these groups. Now, some of these groups it wanted to keep on as a kind of reserve force in case relations soured with India, or relations which have soured with Afghanistan. But the bulk of these kids were really let go by the ISI several years ago, and they've rebounded in a devastating way. And now, of course, some of them have taken on this new tactic of suicide bombing, which wasn't there 5 years ago or even 3 years ago.
Now, the United States is debating how to help Musharraf stop the insurgents who have been attacking inside Pakistan. What kind of help is the U.S. considering providing?
Well, you know, Terry, I mean, you know, my first comment on this is that this is something the U.S. should have been doing 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, it's a bit late to wake up in the day after 600 militants seize a fort that you suddenly wake up and say, well, what should we be doing? But nevertheless, I think the debate is now it's very fraught and it's very strained because there are elements in the U.S. administration, hawkish elements, which actually want to send American troops into the tribal areas, or at least large numbers of special forces, etc., along, you know, to help the Pakistani forces fight there. Now, I think most experts are saying that this would be a disaster because this would increase the anti-Americanism within the tribes, within the people of Pakistan, and it would make the Pakistan government look totally weak and ineffective, even more so than it is. The other course of action is for the Americans to come in and train these paramilitary forces who are guarding the border, who are doing most of the fighting, provide them new weapons, raise their salaries, etc. Now, the problem there is that a lot of these paramilitary forces are also Pashtun tribesmen. They are the brothers, cousins, fathers of the militants. Now, you're asking basically these paramilitary forces, many of them who have had very close links to the extremists, because either they've been part of this Pakistan's policy in the 90s of fighting in Afghanistan, helping the Taliban. Now you're telling these paramilitary forces that, look, actually, the Taliban who you've been helping for the last 15, 20 years are now the bad guys and you have to go and kill them. I think it's very, very difficult for them to do this. So the Americans want to throw a lot of money and weapons and ammunition at these paramilitary forces to train them and to kind of bring them up to speed and hope that this will make them better fighters against the extremists. But that is not going to motivate them. And that is the problem. The problem is in the Pakistan army, whether you're looking at the intelligence or the army or the paramilitary, there's a lack of motivation. Morale is really shot through. These defeats that they've suffered, even minor defeats of losing a fort or an outpost, have really affected morale. Desertion rates have increased. Helicopter pilots are not willing to go and bomb, you know, locations. And some of these paramilitary forces and soldiers are just surrendering rather than fight.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's written extensively about Islamic extremism and is the author of books about the Taliban and about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. Why is what's happening in Pakistan with these militants and the Pakistani Taliban important to the United States?
Well, I think it's just hugely important because what is absolutely clear is that now it is the Pakistan side of the border, that is the Afghan-Pakistan border. It's the Pakistan side of the border which is being used by Al-Qaeda to train militants from right around the world. Just this last week, we had these 14 people arrested in Barcelona, in Spain. 12 of them were Pakistanis. They had links to Al-Qaeda and groups in the tribal areas. They were raising money for them from Barcelona, but they had also been for training, and they also were caught with explosives and detonators. So, you know, you have this potential attack taking place in Spain. And Spain, by the way, is about to have a general election in March. And of course, it was during the last general election in 2004 in Spain that there was this devastating attack on the railway station where nearly 200 Spaniards were killed by Islamic extremist groups. And 2 weeks before that, you had this roundup of militants in Germany. You've had threats in Denmark and Holland. And clearly, what has been happening is that because now so much territory is being controlled or run by Al-Qaeda and its allies, that is the Pakistani Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, that European militants and very possibly militants from the United States are finding it relatively easy to arrive in Pakistan and to travel up there and to end up in a training camp, spend 6 or 8 weeks there and probably meet up with some leaders from Al-Qaeda or somewhere and get tasked to do something back home. And this is where the threat is. And frankly, everyone I've spoken to, government officials in Europe and other people, they're all dreading the fact that, yes, half a dozen plots have been uncovered in Europe, but one plot, God forbid, is going to get through. And then you might have a huge toll of casualties in a European capital or a city. And of course, I mean, the aim would be also to carry out a similar attack in the United States.
Now, these training camps that you're talking about in the frontier regions of Pakistan, do you think that they're training suicide bombers for Iraq?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, there's a separate network which provides European Muslims and Arabs to enter Iraq and to get training there on the job, as it were. I mean, before they blow themselves up, they get training there. And there's a huge sort of pipeline that stretches across France and Spain and Italy and comes into Syria and Jordan. And it's through there that suicide attackers have been coming into Iraq. The traffic that has existed between Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan is even more deadly, and that is a traffic of trainers, that is Arab trainers coming across from Iraq to teach the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban the latest tactics that they've been learning or that they've been practicing there. And of course, the tactics that Al-Qaeda has been using in Iraq against the Americans have been far more deadly than what the Afghans have been using in Afghanistan. And there's a two-way traffic because you've also had reports of Afghan Taliban traveling to Iraq and spending up to 3 months there, getting training and then coming back.
Oh, so the instead of fighters in Iraq getting trained by the Taliban, it's vice versa.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Iraq is still very much the kind of, the academy of guerrilla war in the sense that given that the Americans have developed all these very sophisticated devices to prevent mines blowing up and explosive devices by the roadside to blow up, etc., and the Al-Qaeda extremists have developed countermeasures and counter explosives to make sure that they can penetrate all this new technology. Now, all that technology is also being slowly shifted to Afghanistan to help the Taliban counter NATO and American forces there.
So, you've been describing for us the attacks by the Pakistani Taliban within Pakistan. And you've said that this is affecting the elections. The parliamentary elections have been rescheduled for February 18th. Candidates are afraid to campaign, they're afraid that they'll be attacked. Would people be afraid to show up, even if the candidates were more comfortable campaigning? I mean, is there a climate of fear now in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, there is, and there's a huge question mark over these elections. I mean, a lot of people think that President Musharraf will not hold them. He'll find some excuse not to hold them. There will be, God forbid, another major assassination of some leading political figure, and that will convince him, to postpone the elections indefinitely. The other thinking is that if he does hold the elections, he loses on both counts, in the sense that if free and fair elections are held, it's more than likely that the opposition party, who Musharraf has been deadly opposed to, that includes Bhutto's People's Party and it includes various other smaller parties, will win the majority of seats. Now, if he rigs the elections in favor of his own party, the ruling Muslim League Party, if he rigs the elections in their favor, there's going to be a huge kapow after the elections because people are going to protest and they're not going to put up with the kind of the results of a rigged election. So, I mean, what people are really speculating is that a free and fair election, he's faced with an opposition who he won't be able to live with. And this opposition, once it comes into parliament and forms a government, could impeach him in a process very similar to the American process. On the other hand, if he doesn't and he rigs the elections, he could face a major protest movement in the streets.
The New York Times reported, based on anonymous sources within Pakistan's intelligence agency, that the ISI, the intelligence agency, manipulated Pakistan's previous election. What do you know about that?
Well, this is forming quite a part of my book. I mean, they certainly did manipulate the elections in 2002. I mean, we should remember that all the leading politicians, I mean, the three leading politicians in Pakistan were all in exile at the time. And two of these parties, Bhutto's party and the Muslim League faction led by a former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, were really not allowed to take part. And they were harassed and jailed and not allowed to take part. And all the rigging was done in favor of this conglomerate party that was put together by the intelligence services, basically to give support to the military regime of President Musharraf. So there was a lot of rigging, pre-rigging, that is rigging done before the elections, new laws that were passed which made it almost impossible for the opposition parties to run, and then rigging on the day, which was done not in the old traditional way of sort of stuffing ballot boxes, but done through computers, because the results, all the results have to go up by computer. They were not announced at each polling station as they are anywhere else in the world. They go up by computer to the so-called Election Commission. And the suspicion was that in between there was the ISI, that the results were first going up to the ISI, and who were then doctoring the results and then sending them on to the Election Commission. So all this is now, will this be repeated all over again? I mean, this is what people are really nervous about.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist whose books include Taliban and Jihad. He's speaking to us from Davos, Switzerland, where he's attending the World Economic Forum. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Touchstone, a novel of suspense and intrigue set in Britain between two world wars, by Laurie R. King, author of The Game. And from Cabot Creamery, committed to the cooperative spirit since 1919 and owned by the New England farm families who make all-natural Vermont cheddar cheese. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid talks about the aftermath of the Benazir Bhutto assassination and his final conversation with her. He knows her family well. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Sue Miller's new novel, The Senator's Wife.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ahmed Rashid. He's a Pakistani journalist who has written extensively about Islamic extremism. His books include Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We're talking about the increase in suicide attacks within Pakistan and the aftermath of the Benazir Bhutto assassination. The parliamentary election in which she hoped to emerge as prime minister has been rescheduled for February 18th. Now, you say that evidence is emerging that President Musharraf fooled both the Americans and Benazir Bhutto about the power-sharing deal that he said he wanted to participate in with Bhutto. What is the evidence?
Well, the major evidence, you know, simply has been that, you know, there was a list, I think, of actions that were agreed between Bhutto and Musharraf and the Americans before Bhutto returned home. Now, when she did come home, she was battling with Musharraf to get him to implement these, his part of the deal. And that included a new election commission, which would be a neutral body and not a body, you know, under the control of the military. It was the closing down of the local government officials, because all these local government officials were helping the army and helping the ruling party, and they were very much against the People's Party. There were several of these points, and all concluded with the Americans in the chair, if you like, in order to have a free and fair election. And Musharraf had promised this, and they were never implemented. And Benazir's frustration grew more and more as the weeks passed, because he just wasn't implementing them. And he kept saying, well, we'll discuss everything after the elections, which were at that time scheduled for January the 8th. And she made it very clear that she thought that she'd been made a fool of and that the Americans had been made a fool of. And just before her death, she had spoken to the American ambassador. She'd sent off an envoy to Washington to meet with Condoleezza Rice to make all these points again, that this deal is breaking down. And there's no point now in having an election which Musharraf has not fulfilled his side of the bargain. Now, what happened after her death has been this incredibly callous way that Musharraf has dealt with the death. I mean, first of all, he's shown absolutely no remorse. His main argument is that literally she deserved it, because she stood up. If you remember, she was killed by standing up in her jeep, which was a bulletproof jeep, and she stood up through a window in the roof and was waving to the people and was then shot and then blown up. And Musharraf said she had no business standing up. It was all her own fault. She was asking for it virtually. And he said that not once, but several times. He said it to the foreign press. He said it to the local press. He said it to the foreign diplomats. And I spoke to a couple of ambassadors who were just horrified. I mean, one thing is that, you know, she was your enemy, but, you know, somebody of that stature dies and the whole nation is in mourning. The nation wants some words of solace from the head of state. I mean, it doesn't want this completely cold-hearted lack of remorse. And then, subsequently, apart from that, he said it frequently that she was not liked nor trusted by the army. Now, implying that, you know, even if she'd won the elections, we in the army or the army would not necessarily have allowed her to rule. And that has also obviously shocked people who are still in a state of mourning.
You spoke to Benazir Bhutto about 3 weeks before she died. I mean, you'd spoken to her many times, but that was the latest before her death. And in that conversation, she told you that the United States pressured her to stay in the alliance with Musharraf, even though he didn't like her and she didn't trust him. What kind of pressure was the United States putting on her?
Well, I think there was a lot of personal pressure, you know, from Vice President Cheney, his office, and from Condoleezza Rice, and from the Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia, Richard Boucher. Now, the Americans could, at that point in time, with this deal breaking down, as it were, they couldn't contemplate anything else. And they were just urging her to stay in there and they'd work on Musharraf. But it seems that, you know, Musharraf was basically snubbing the Americans at that point. And the way he was doing it was that he was offering more cooperation in the tribal areas against the extremists. We now know that, you know, there are more special forces, American special forces, have arrived in the tribal areas. They are active there. Now, presumably, he was trading off greater cooperation with the Americans against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but demanding his pound of flesh, which was that don't pressure me on giving any more concessions to Benazir before the elections, and I will do the elections as I please. And I think the Americans basically bought it. I mean, which is why they didn't change policy before. And that is why she was so frustrated, because there was this trade-off that Musharraf had kind of done with the Americans, which was really frustrating her.
Now Benazir Bhutto's son is the official head of the party that she headed, the Pakistan People's Party. But he's 19, he's still in college, and the college he's going to, Oxford, is in England. So he won't actively head the party until he graduates, which will take a minimum of 3 years. And in the meantime, his father is going to chair the party. And his father has asked reporters not to question his son because his son is at a tender age. I mean, it really sounds more like a royal family. It sounds more like a crown prince who's not mature enough to sit on the throne yet. I think it's really hard for Americans to understand why the son is the head of the party at the age of 19.
Well, you know, I can appreciate that. But, you know, Terry, I was down, you know, at her graveside for 3 days a couple of weeks ago. And I mean, you know, millions of people are still arriving and grief-stricken people, but also people who are very, very angry at the government, at the army, etc. And these are not just supporters, but, you know, middle-class women, people from all walks of life, from all ethnic groups across the country, Afghans, Indians, Nepalese. I saw all sorts of people from, you know, from the region, people who had a lot of respect for her. Now, I mean, I agree. I mean, it's a difficult thing to swallow, but it's something that at least I think her party for the time being has swallowed. I think there's such a state of shock. They definitely needed the continuation of a Bhutto, and it has been accepted. There's very little question in the party or in Pakistan as to what has happened. Now, outside and even, you know, for many educated Pakistanis, it is absurd. Clearly, you know, there is a dynastic succession which is not democratic at all, and how can you have a dynastic succession in a party which claims to be the most democratic party in Pakistan and also has the largest standing and is a national party? It's right across the country. But I think, you know, the hour and the shock and, you know, everything that has gone after this assassination, it's been an incredibly traumatic time. You just can't imagine the way Pakistanis have felt. I mean, as a journalist, as a person very concerned with human rights and all the rest of it, I mean, you know, people have grown up their whole lives with Benazir there, even though she was in exile for 9 years. I mean, you know, her statements were always front page news in Pakistan. People have grown up with her commenting on everything under the sun, etc. And whether you liked her or not, she was very much part of the political makeup in the country, part of the furniture, if you like. And to suddenly have this huge vacuum being created, I think that's why a lot of the people have accepted this appointment of the son and the father as regent.
But the father has been accused of corruption. He spent several years in prison on corruption convictions. So how much faith is there in him?
Well, again, huge doubts. Of course, the father spent 8 years in jail, but charges that were never proved. So he was never proven guilty. And there are also corruption cases abroad in Spain and in Switzerland. But yes, I mean, he has gone out of his way. I met him, and he's really trying to go out of his way to say, look, the past is the past. I spent 8 years in jail. I paid my dues. Of course, he denies that he is corrupt. And I'm not the leader of the party. My son will eventually take over, and I'm going to try and initiate a kind of collective leadership. Now, there's a central committee, which is made up of 54 people in the party, and there is no doubt that he has initiated a kind of collective decision making. He hasn't gone out on a limb, you know, trying to do things. He's always calling meeting with the rest of the party people, and trying to take a collective decision. And of course, that's terribly important, because if he doesn't do that, the party could well split. I mean, there are people in the party who don't like him at all, and there are people who are willing to put up with him perhaps for 6 months to a year, but no longer than that. So he has to win all these kind of doubting Thomases. He's got to win them all over. in order to fight the elections and and in order to confront the military. I think one very conciliatory move he's made is that he has said that he will not be prime minister, and he will appoint the number two in the party, Amin Fahim, to be the prime minister if the party wins the elections.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's written extensively about Islamic extremism and is the author of books about the Taliban and about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. We've been talking about the aftermath of the Benazir Bhutto assassination. There have been some suspicions that the Musharraf government was somehow complicit in the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, and that the government is now trying to cover up what happened or not do as thorough an investigation as possible. Can you give us an update on how much is known about how the assassination happened and what, if any, involvement there was on the part of the Musharraf government?
Well, you know, after a lot of international pressure, Musharraf agreed to call in Scotland Yard. Now, and they sent five or six detectives, but they were mandated only to make a report on how she was killed, not who killed her. Now, of course, she was buried without a post-mortem, so there's a huge debate going on and whether she was shot first or whether she hurt her head on the car window or whether she was blown up first. And, you know, presumably the Scotland Yard report, even without exhuming the body, is going to be issuing some kind of report on how she was killed. We then get to the tricky part of who killed her. Now, there is, of course, enormous depth of feeling amongst many people, especially in the People's Party, that the government killed her. I mean, I really don't accept that. I mean, I don't think, you know, Musharraf ordered a killing or anyone near at that level did that. But having said that, there are certainly elements in the intelligence agencies, in the military, who loathed her, who were very sympathetic to the extremists. I think she was killed as part of an extremist plot. Possibly those extremists had internal information, etc., from these people in intelligence, from people in police, people who were supposed to be guarding her from the government side. And we've seen a lot of that in the last few months, because we've seen these devastating attacks, suicide attacks and bomb attacks on army and security personnel, which clearly are result of inside jobs, in the sense that that information must have come from inside as to, you know, where these soldiers were moving, etc. So I think, you know, at the top of my head, without any evidence, I mean, I think the more logical explanation would be that this was a plot by extremists. They feared her winning the elections, because she may have allowed the Americans a much greater presence in Pakistan, a military presence. She would have urged the army to double the efforts against the extremists, to go up hard against them. She would have done perhaps a lot of the things that, you know, the extremists really would have hurt the extremists very much. So I think it was part of an extremist plot, but I think there's every reason to believe that there were elements, perhaps lower down in the security services, people who were helping these extremists.
President Musharraf has decided to go on a speaking tour of Europe, and he's making a stop tomorrow at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which is where you are now attending that forum. What's reaction there to the fact that he's going to be visiting tomorrow?
Well, people are quite amazed as to, you know, I mean, I've been speaking to a lot of people this morning, and they're really quite shocked. And they've been asking me, I mean, why is he coming? You know, you've got 2,500 people here, business leaders, politicians, heads of state, you know, movers and shakers of the world. And they're quite surprised as to why he's coming, knowing his very, very weak position and knowing the kind of very aggressive position of the media and of the political parties in Europe. He was at the European Parliament 2 days earlier. He addressed them, and really he was blasted by the members of the European Parliament for imprisoning judges and censoring the media and, you know, doing all that he's done in the last few months. And then he went on to Paris yesterday. He was given a very tough time by the French press. He's appearing in three different occasions in the space of 48 hours. And I mean, I have no doubt he's going to get roasted by the audience and by the press, which is here in hundreds and hundreds. He really believes, I think, that he can make a comeback, that he can regain international credibility, that he can make a comeback, that he can hold these elections and then remain as president. But I think a lot of people are very, very doubtful. I mean, today, you know, in Pakistan, you've had a huge list of retired generals who signed a letter demanding his resignation. Now, that is hugely significant in a country where the military never criticizes its own. A retired general will never criticize a serving general. And here you have a situation where you have some very prominent generals who are very well known to the public, retired generals, signing on to this letter. So, I mean, you know, that is the kind of atmosphere that exists around him at the moment.
You know, you told us at the beginning of the interview that Lahore, which is where you live, recently had its first suicide bomber attack. And so I'm wondering, are you any less comfortable? Do you feel less safe than you did just a few weeks ago in your home city?
Well, yes. I mean, I think everyone is feeling very unsafe. And I think people, the fact that at the one level they've gone after, you know, army and police, but at another level they've gone after politicians and liberals, really means that the next level of attack is going to be on human rights workers, on journalists, on women's activists, people who are prominent in liberal causes in Pakistan. And I think the extremists don't just want to destabilize the country. They don't just want to wipe out liberal politicians or pro-Western politicians, pro-democracy politicians. They also want to wipe out the backup for that. And the backup for that is this very fledgling civil society that we have in Pakistan, which is just, in fact, I mean, it's really only emerged in the last 1 year, you know, protesting against Musharraf and against military rule. But it's very vibrant, it's very active, and it comprises all sorts of people, lawyers, doctors, journalists, women activists, NGOs, teachers, a lot of school teachers. So that is really, I mean, God forbid, but if the next bomb blast is going to be, for example, against a very prominent girls' school, or prominent teachers, or prominent journalists, or prominent women's activists, you know, people who are not necessarily known outside the country, but are very well known inside the country, I think this is going to lead to an absolutely terrifying repercussions, because, you know, I think a lot of your liberal elite will then seriously think about moving out.
Are you thinking about leaving?
No, not at all. I mean, not at all. No. I wouldn't like to leave. I mean, you know, certainly not. And I mean, there's no way I would be happy living for any length of time anywhere else apart from Pakistan. And, you know, that's where my life is and that's where my job is. And, you know, that's what I write about. And but, you know, I mean, there has been it's depressing because, you know, just before 9/11, you know, I was writing and I wrote the book Taliban, which said that, you know, you have to rescue Afghanistan. The world has to rescue Afghanistan from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And the world did rescue Afghanistan from Al-Qaeda, but only, unfortunately, after 3,000 Americans were killed in the Twin Towers. But now, you know, you're not back to square one now. You're back to minus one. That is what is so depressing in the whole region. I mean, Afghanistan is also suffering enormously right now, and things are going backwards there too. You know, unfortunately, what I'm seeing is really there was a blip, a short blip in 2002, when it seemed like the U.S. and Europe and, you know, the West would understand their responsibilities in this part of the world and fulfill them and do reconstruction and do nation building and, you know, all the rest of it that was expected. And then, you know, the Americans went off and fought a war in Iraq, which of course was just the major distraction from this part of the world. And now I consider this part, my part of the world, even much more dangerous than Iraq, potentially, because this is where extremism is. This is where the training for global terrorism is taking place. This is where, from where the whole world can be affected. Now, you know, Iraq is bad enough, but, you know, Iraq will affect, the ripple effects of Iraq will affect Iran, they'll affect the Middle East to some extent, but they won't affect necessarily the whole world. God forbid another major terrorist attack, hitting America or hitting London or Paris, which is then traced back to Waziristan or one of the tribal areas in Pakistan, would be absolutely devastating for Pakistan and leave the world wondering what on earth we're going to do.
Well, Ahmed Rashid, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I hope I didn't scare you.
Well, I'm not going to say it's not alarming what you have to report, but... I appreciate your reporting it to us. So thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist. His next book will be about nation building in Pakistan and Afghanistan and U.S. policy after 9/11. He spoke to us from Davos, Switzerland, where he's attending the World Economic Forum. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Sue Miller's new novel, The Senator's Wife. This is Fresh Air. It's January, the writer's strike is still dragging on, and the stock market has gone crazy. But book critic Maureen Carrigan says there's at least one piece of good news this month. Sue Miller has a new novel. It's called The Senator's Wife, and Maureen says that fans of Miller's previous novels, like The Good Mother, While I Was Gone, and Inventing the Abbots, should give themselves a midwinter treat and read it.
Acting out of a Calvinist attitude toward book reviewing, I tend to refrain from reading Sue Miller's novels. I'm always sure I'm going to be completely engrossed by whatever new book of hers has just come out. Therefore, I try to stay away because reviewing her just doesn't feel like enough work. So it was with this latest novel, The Senator's Wife. I read three quarters of another book, a nonfiction meditation on old age and death, no less, trying to stand firm against Miller's literary attractions. It was no good. The edgy meditation on oblivion turned out to be labored and unenlightening, and I began slipping away from it to sneak read chapters of The Senator's Wife. Ultimately, Miller's novel, too, is about old age, as well as the complexities of marriage and the projections and betrayals that people inflict upon one another. Miller is such a crisp writer, so lucid and precise and emotionally astute, it's never work to read her novels. Instead, it takes senseless effort to resist them. The provocative and timely title of Miller's latest book conjures up those smiling, knit-suited, wifely helpmeets who are once again materializing behind the candidates' shoulders at campaign events. Bill Clinton is now the exception, of course, but Miller sets her book mostly in the early 1990s, when Bill and Hillary were fixed in their traditional gender roles. The Clintons and their troubled marriage are presiding, if distant, presences in this novel. When the story begins, a newly married couple in their 30s, Mary and Nathan, have just bought an attached late Victorian house in the New England college town of Williston. Nathan is a hotshot, pleased with himself and his new position as professor of political science and history at the college. Like many of Miller's male characters, he's there because the plot needs him to be, but he's not a chief object of interest. Mary is, well, trailing alongside Nathan, a woman who happily embraces an old lover's description of her as an attractive version of Pete Rose. Mary has led a scratched-together life. She falls into things, like the community college education which eventually led her away from her tough working-class roots, like this marriage to Nathan. But the psychic price she pays for these passive dislocations is that she's eternally uncomfortable in her own skin. The house that shares a wall with Mary and Nathan's new home belongs to Delia Naughton, wife of former Senator Tom Naughton, who was a progressive mover and shaker in Washington during the 1960s and 70s. Decades ago, Senator Naughton mysteriously dropped out of political life, and even more mysteriously, doesn't live with Delia, although he appears occasionally for what she airily describes as ceremonial visits. It's no surprise that infidelity is to blame for the senator's political fall and marital distance. Part of Miller's project in this novel is to explore what keeps a couple together after such a wound. In the particular case of the Naughtons, Miller also wants to trace the odd alternative shape that a marriage can subsequently grow into. But just as compelling and even suspenseful as the story of the Naughtons' marriage is the evolution of the relationship between Mary and Delia. As Mary recognizes, the emotional stinginess of her own mother has made her a sucker for the attentions of an older woman, and Delia, charming, at ease, still beautiful in her 70s, becomes Mary's longed-for maternal idol. Her career as a Washington political spouse, however, has made Delia both warm and elusive. As Miller's roaming, omniscient narrator puts it, Delia was good, she felt she was good anyway, at the honest answer that still didn't reveal much. Deprived of something she wants from Delia that she can't even name, Mary begins to snoop into the private recesses of Delia's life and ultimately commits an act of infidelity to her that defies available labels. Sue Miller may be an easy writer to read in the sense that she's a master of realistic fiction, but she never settles for the easy emotional answers, the facile plot twist, the prefab moral of the story. Like the classic wifely suits Delia Naughton wore on the campaign trail, Miller's traditional way of presenting a story never goes out of style.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Senator's Wife by Sue Miller. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from LendingTree.com, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jacob Weisberg, editor-in-chief of the online magazine Slate. He says his new book, The Bush Tragedy, isn't an indictment of the president. It's an attempt to analyze what went wrong. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.